We present Beachcomber by the Way, selections from the humour of J.B. Morton, with Richard Ingrams as the author.
Hello, morons.
Interruptions by John Wells as Prodnose.
Well, takes one to know one.
You bastard.
With the considerable talents of Miss June Whitfield, Mr. John Sessions, Miss Joan Sims, Miss Patricia Routledge, Mr. Simon Greenall, Mr. Brian Bowles, and Miss Henrietta Garden. Beachcomber by the Way.
Good day to you, my lily-livered listeners. And now news of a delightful old folk custom, or, if you prefer, a quaint attempt to provide photo opportunities for tourists.
Cynic.
Cretin. That makes it one all, I think.
Hmm.
Since Saxon days, the people of Chopham Bivney have been bringing in the snedge. Tomorrow at dawn, the snedge-bringers will assemble in the old tithe barn, and then, led by the master snedger, they will walk on stilts to the gold cross in the marketplace, singing the 8th-century huck song and wearing their gilt cardboard hats. The oldest woman in Chopham Bivney, Mrs. Brass, aged 104, will then read out the skrin list, after which four young men will haul the snedge from Cowdown to the crossroads. It is a picturesque ceremony, and Professor Towle states in his East Mercian folk ceremonies that it probably goes back to the days of Egfrith the Bald.
Fascinating, but what is the snedge?
Ah, that has never been revealed. I suspect it is some kind of fanshare or whelk plough.
I never know when to believe you.
No? Well, here's a good occasion. I shall boot you through that door if you're not soon gone from my sight, you footly little dullard.
There, I do believe you. Goodbye.
I was lying, of course. The snedge is actually an old Oatler's gulving horn. And now a tale of derring-do set neath the skies of old Tibet. It concerns the redoubtable Colonel Egham of the British Secret Service and his far-from-secret passion for the exotic Tibetan beauty, Queen Dingy Poos. Alas, for Egham, his love is not returned, yet every mission upon which he is sent seems destined to throw the two of them together. Today's stirring story relates Egham's efforts to break up a Nazi spy ring operating in Afghanistan in 1942, and begins, naturally, with Egham's arrival on Yakbak in the Tibetan village of Dung, disguised as a Swedish botanist named Bunsen. This true tale could not be told for over 50 years, though more for reasons of taste than of national security.
Neath Tibetan Skies, a tale of derring-do in old Tibet. Which is actually older now than it was then, if you see what I mean. Anyway, Tibet, 1942.
Egham here. It was with a fluttering of the heart and a considerable dirtying of the putties that I once more set foot on Tibetan soil, home to that inestimable dusky beauty, Queen Dingy Poos. Gad! On a moonless winter evening, I rode my yak up the main street of Dung, also the only street of Dung, and dismounted outside the Lama's Arms. I demanded the best room in the house and got it, along with 37 other people. The squinting landlord showed me to my corner, and by the time I unpacked my Swedish copy of Wild Flowers of Tibet, it was known throughout Dung that a stranger had arrived.
Ah, von Kaufleisch, you cool Teutonic militarist.
Ja, Dingy Poos, mein Riegel Tibetan Tentres.
This newly arrived Swedish botanist, I shall twist him while my little finger.
There are no flies on you. Well, one or two, maybe.
The next morning, I received a heavily scented note from Dingy Poos asking me to brick tea at her summer residence. No doubt I was being sounded and would get to meet the chief German spies. With thick blue glasses and a red wig, my disguise was complete. At 4 p.m. precisely, I presented myself to the exotically costumed tribesman guarding the door to Dingy Poos' sumptuous palace. Professor Bunsen to see Her Serene Majesty Queen Dingy Poos.
Good Lord, it's Egham, isn't it? How are you, old chap? It's me, Butterwick of Military Intelligence.
What, old chanters? Is it really you want me for it? Goodness, Are we both on the same mission?
Oh, no. I'm on my annual leave. Would have stayed in England, just thought Bognor seemed a little dull after all that spy stuff. Can't get enough of it, you know. You just go ahead and win the war for us, or whatever it is you're up to. Don't mind me. Not a word to anyone that I'm not Tibetan.
Oh, no, my lips are sealed.
Good chap. Only if my boss here finds out I haven't forged my CV, I'll be out of my ear. Told him I had 6 months' previous experience. Nothing of the sort. Keep it to yourself, eh? Thanks awfully. Now, in you go. They're expecting you. Professor Bunsen.
I entered the palace, and affecting a slight hunch, I brought myself once again into the perfumed presence of that exotic, regal beauty, Queen Dingipoos. Gad! I kissed her hand, though my lips craved more.
Professor Bunsen, have you met Oberleutnant Kurt von Kerbfleisch and his unsmiling band of Nazi officers?
Heil Hitler!
Termed, I'm sure.
Tell me, Professor, just in case you should happen to be an enemy spy in rather poor disguise, tell me what you think of England.
England? Oh, it is a Jewish plutocracy, spent force, doomed to destruction. Heil Hitler.
Good. No true Englishman could have brought himself to say that.
Yeah, the things one must do to serve one's country. May God and my king forgive me.
Yeah. We too despise the English, do we not, Queen Dingipoo?
Yes. I was in love with an Englishman once.
What?
He was a journalist. Tall and handsome as a god. But he spurned me. His name was Beachcomber.
Oh.
That is why I hate the English.
I have also heard mention of a Colonel Eagle.
He is a fool. He fell in love with me. But I merely used him and tossed him aside like I do with all the men since Beachcomber.
Oh, well, lucky that I'm Swedish, then.
Excuse me, your most captivating highness. But I have this moment spotted someone to whom I must just go and be unfeelingly cruel. I hope we speak again, Herr Bunsen.
Ah, such Teutonic grace. No wonder that everywhere Germany is winning the war. Their troops hold Moscow and Leningrad. The English are out of Africa. The Japanese have conquered Texas, Maine, and South Carolina.
That's not the latest news, my lady.
Ha! Is that better? Show me.
From inside my tunic, I brought out a bundle of English newspapers and handed them to her. She read the headlines with a growing look of anguished realization.
These English newspapers, they never lie. The Nazis must have deceived me.
An Englishman never deceives a lady. Yeah, if I remove this wig, possibly you may recognize me.
Colonel Egger, you're mad fool.
If it is foolish to love without return, yes, then I suppose I am mad, Dingipoos. I can never forget you. Kiss me.
Colonel, please. Get off me. Oh. This is no time for horse play. Or yak play, rather, as we call it. Hiss. Here come our mutual enemies.
Get the wig.
What in Himmel, Herr Bunsen? Why does a Swedish botanist wear a wig?
A wig? Yes, simple, to avoid the keen eyes of Anglo-Saxon spies. The swine? Forgive me, England.
A likely story. This is Tibet. There are no English spies here. Search Herr Bunsen's pockets.
Ah, a picture postcard of the Western Superman.
Yeah, and an English passport and an English watch. And even a telegram from the British Foreign Office.
Well, Herr Bunsen, perhaps you can explain, no?
Yes, perhaps, gentlemen. All these incriminating items are merely my credentials carried to deceive any English agents. A true British spy would hardly be so stupid as to keep them on his person, would he?
Some of them are stupid, I believe.
Herr Bunsen, we were trying to doubt you. Please accept our apologies, and as a sign of good faith, this. Our sole copy of our top-secret Nazi plans to invade India. Study them at your ease and return them to me when you are finished. Heil Hitler!
Heil Hitler! Thank you, Heil Hitler. And now I think I must be going. I have some rare Tibetan dandelions to look at. Thanks awfully again for the plan.
Come here, Bunsen. I'll show you to the door.
You can go.
Quickly! In here! Before Von Kalfreich comes looking for me, driven mad by the thought of my dusky Asian beauty.
Oh, gad, Gingy Paws, have you broken a lot of men's hearts?
Yes, along with three noses and a collarbone. Hmm. So don't try that kissing thing again. Now get in there!
Ow! I found myself alone in a perfumed boudoir with the only woman in the world who meant anything to me, intoxicated by the hideous scent and the radiant beauty of that Tibetan orchid-made flesh. I forgot all thoughts of the war and clans and gad, yes, even England. Our eyes met in the soft candlelight. My hand stroked the soft skin of her exquisite cheek, and she seized my wrists and threw me to the floor, using a skillful throw known only to her and a handful of Buddhist monks.
I told you not to try any of that stuff.
Pulling me to my feet, this Tibetan Mata Hari then led me through a false panel in the wall of the room and down a subterranean tunnel which emerged on the main road to the Khyber Pass. Here, a large, fast car was waiting for us. Dingy Paws jumped behind the wheel, and with our foot to the floor, the vehicle sped away.
I thought you were sitting in the back, you idiot!
Sorry, you were too quick for me. Where are we going?
Through Afghanistan to India and freedom! Where you can present those plans to British authorities. Damn! Look behind us! We're being followed! How could they have realized so quickly?
Well, if you would give me a lift like this, Mr. Von Kalbflash, and I'd been told all you Jerry Trappers were inhuman brutes. That's the mere military intelligence for you, eh?
Think nothing of it, Mr. Butterwick. Your amusing anecdote about Herr Bunsen really being an English spy named Eggum was more than adequate recompense. God in Himmel, that woman drives like a demon. The world's most beautiful demon, of course.
On we sped over the Rahahaba Mountains and along the hairpin road up the Chikan Pass, the Hun all the time gaining on us as night began to fall. Then, in our rearview mirror, we saw Kalfflash's car screech to a halt and Butterwick step out to stretch his legs. No sooner was he out of the car than Kalfflash pulled away without him, a typical Nazi trick. However, through Butterwick's brave sacrifice, we were able to gain valuable distance and so leave Kalfflash behind in the darkness. Tired and hungry, we at last pulled up outside the mountain residence of Half Another, the Afghan chief, high in the hills above Kabul. The swarthy chief invited us to join him in a light repast of brick tea and rancid yak butter. We accepted gladly, but uncertain of his sympathies, I felt it wise to reassume the persona of Bunsen, the Swedish botanist.
Delicious, Chief. Have another.
Good. I do so like having people come for tea, yeah. Particularly such strong supporters of the Nazi cause as the beautiful Dingy Paws.
Oh, your father may have another.
And her renowned Swedish friend, Herr Bunsen. I wonder perhaps you know my other guest?
What other guest?
Come in, Oberleutnant von Kalbflash.
Ha! Like your violin, we meet again, Colonel Eggham. Hand over the plans. Good. But now I am afraid you and this beautiful but deceitful woman whom I love in vain must die. Get over by that wall, both of you, please.
May I just remind you, Herr Kalbflash, that beautiful but deceitful woman is my wife.
What?
Deny it, Dingy Paws. Say it is not so.
I cannot. It is true.
Then I have behaved dishonorably. Farewell, Mrs. Havanada. I go to volunteer for the Russian front. Here, keep the plans to remind you of me. Auf Wiedersehen, gentlemen.
Excellent. He's gone, and the plans are ours, which is really rather spiffing, actually.
Just a moment. You're no pure-blooded Afghan.
No,
who are
no.
you?
Lord Totteridge of Whetstone, MI7, at your service, sir. Would you help me off with this hideous outfit?
And so, less than 24 hours later, Dingy Poos and I were sitting side by side in the lounge of the Grand Hotel at Khachmal, Pearl of the Afghan Riviera. I had the top-secret plans for the German invasion of India in an inside jacket pocket, but the one thing I really wanted was still far beyond my grasp, the heart of Dingy Poos. How could I return to England without her?
So, you are married already, and now I know that we two can never be together as one and all that.
Married? Oh, no. Lord Totteridge is not really my husband.
What?
Neither he nor Kalbfash ever knew the real me.
Oh.
Nor the 370 others.
300?
No. No man can ever get close to me again. No man but one.
Beachcomber, I suppose.
Yes, Beachcomber. If I thought he cared even a little for me, I would be happy.
Ah, Beachcomber. What have you in common with that spoilt darling of the upper ten? That wealthy, heartless ne'er-do-well from whom English mothers hide their daughters? Beau Brummel and Don Juan of Fleet Street, Scourge of Ludgate Hill, Terror of Shoe Lane, these are his names.
Oh, how fascinating he sounds.
Ah, well, I'm man enough to admit defeat. I shall leave you now, but believe me, I shall often think of Dung and of those moonlit evenings when I dared to hope that you could love me.
Ah, my foolish, faithful one. Come, before you go, let us embrace and kiss goodbye as any two friends might.
And so, seizing his chance at last, Egham folded her in his arms and sought her lips, whilst at the same time Dingy Poo's slender fingers sought out the plans concealed in Egham's jacket pocket. As she withdrew with a pretty protest from his attempted kiss, the plans came with her, and it was a simple movement to thrust them quickly into the top of her gauze-like stocking.
With Carlfish out of the way, these will fetch a pretty penny from Wishy Washy, that most fascinating of Japanese attaches.
She thought to herself, as she blew a kiss to Egham, and he sailed away trustingly to New Delhi.
Oh, you're typing. Can I come in without being subjected to the usual barrage of insults?
Assuredly, my dear Pradnes. This is Be Kind to Animals Week.
You started, I see.
No, in fact, I finished.
Finished what?
The second half of the entries for S in my dictionary for today.
Oh, no.
Oh, yes. Spirit, a voice in a dark room saying that Uncle is well and the weather fine.
Hooey.
Stoic, a dyspeptic millionaire on a diet.
Tosh.
Strong. An adjective of praise applied to any brutally ugly piece of sculpture or to any unintelligible picture.
Piffle!
Strong, silent type. A man with an immobile face who has nothing to say on any subject. Strung, highly. Excuse made for any child in need of a good thrashing.
Poppycock!
Superstition. A noun accompanying the adjective medieval.
Rot!
Surprise. Every marriage of a film actress is reported in the gossip column.
Pish!
And finally...
Thank goodness!
Symbolism. Anything in art which is unintelligible to the normal man. That thereby excludes you, of course, Prodnos.
Can you really not think of anything better to do than continually make fun of me?
Indeed I can. Allow me to demonstrate. Begone, cuttlefish.
Ah!
Ah, it does a man good to have a hobby.
They won the toss, they won the rubber, but English sportsmen will not blubber. They merely feel the duty done, that it's a shame the best team won.
And now some hot, or rather not so hot, news from the world of science. Dr. Strabismus, whom God preserve of Utrecht, has invented a new kind of match, which differs from other matches in one major aspect. It is the only match currently being discussed by the doctor and our roving Beachcomber News reporter in a field at Waggling Parva this very moment.
So, Dr. Strabismus,
whom God preserve,
yes, of Utrecht, this new match you've invented, tell me about it.
Well, in order to stop heat and woodland fires, I have invented an asbestos match which cannot be struck.
I see. But wouldn't no match at all be just as safe as one that can't be lit?
Quite possibly, which is why my match is one that cannot be struck. And as to no match at all being as safe as my new match, we must not forget that it is dropped matches that cause forest fires and not no matches. Therefore, if the dropped matches have never been struck because they're unstrikable, they cannot cause fires. Ergo, they are safer than no matches.
But what's the use of them? They couldn't, say, light a cigarette, could they?
Of course not. If they could light cigarettes, they could cause heath and woodland fires. Did I not tell you that they were what I was trying to stop?
Yes, 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 you did. So, as far as nature lovers are concerned, you might say it's a match made in heaven.
No, it is a match made here in my laboratories in Waggling Parva.
Yes. Dr. Strabismus,
whom God preserve,
of Utrecht, thank you.
Thank you.
Back now to the studio.
Oh, I need a fag after that.
Oh, damn. Why won't these matches light?
Scientists whom I've consulted consider that if you could train an ape to take prints of sheep's noses on cigarette cards for 250,000 years... you would have at the end the most exhaustive collection of useless material ever made.
Excluding the stuff you come up with, I suppose.
Silence, Nettlerash! One advantage of the card collection is that you need not buy an encyclopedia. If the lady next to you at dinner says, "Tell me, Mr. Spofforth, what is the tonnage of the oldest ship in the Brazilian Navy?" or, in a thrillingly low voice, "What bird lays an egg with bright yellow spots on it?" you would no doubt have the answer in your informative cigarette card collection. And you can, at the same time, tell her a good deal about nose prints of sheep, a subject not yet part of the curriculum at Rodine or Cheltenham. So foully reactionary are they.
Who on earth would want to know about sheep's noses?
Other sheep, for a start. In fact, the government is so fearful of the prospect of hordes of unlicensed sheep terrorising the countryside that it has appointed at great expense a commission of inquiry, which will investigate the practicalities, if there are any, of taking prints of the ovine proboscis on the backs of cigarette cards. It is hoped that a number of useful things will come out of this, not the least of them being to distract attention from the government's many other failings. So seriously is Whitehall taking the matter that the commission has been set up in the Monument Room at Appleby with the inestimable Mrs. Utter Wretch as chairperson. She is, of course, the wife of Colonel Wretch, master of Wretch Manor, and a man heartily sick of being reminded of his wife's earlier career before their marriage as a trapeze artist in Wugwell's circus. Apologies once again, Colonel. It is the Commission's intention to call a large number of top-notch witnesses to give evidence about all areas of sheep's nose printing.
Ladies and gentlemen, I take great pleasure in pronouncing this inquiry open and call the first witness, the brave, the death-defying... Oh, dear, excuse me. Old habits die hard. call Colonel Hepstow.
Good day, Madam Chairman. Ladies and gentlemen, my name's Colonel Oliver Hepstow, and I farm 124,000 acres over in the West Country. Livestock, mostly. And in 41 years of farming, I have never had occasion to take a print of a sheep's nose. Yeah. If I ever found myself doing such a thing, I'd certainly choose something more suitable than a cigarette card.
Absolutely. In your opinion, Colonel, is a cigarette card big enough to take the print of a sheep's nose?
Well, obviously, that would depend upon the size of the nose and the size of the, whatchamacallit, card.
Madam Chairman, may I put it to you as a member of this commission that a table mat might better suffice as a nose print receptacle?
Table? diplomats are outside the brief of this inquiry, Mr. Batliff.
Even when featuring rustic scenes?
Whatever, well, I think it's ridiculous. Nose prints. Only sheep that misbehaved or showed with false criminal tendencies shall be required to submit to this indignity.
Thank you, Colonel. Your views have been noted.
Thank you.
Call Mr. Colston.
Seems to me perfectly clear. No, I put it to you, ladies and gentlemen, that it would be far more practical and indeed hygienic to photograph the noses of sheep than to take prints.
But would that method sufficiently bring out the difference between the noses?
Well, there are no differences.
Oh,
sir.
Oh, come on.
I don't think I can. I think we'd better disregard that evidence. Strike it from the record.
Very well, Miss Strange.
Excuse me, but has anyone thought of taking the nose prints of fish?
That is hardly germane to the argument, Mr. Twemlow.
Perhaps not. It could be done on blotting paper.
Surely the nose is generally so near the mouth in a fish that you would get mouth prints too.
Gentlemen, fish are not our business.
Yes, they are. I run a milk store.
Oh,
that makes sense, doesn't it?
Oh, dear. Lunch, everybody.
After an abominable lunch, the nose print, (sheep), Commission, was fortunate to hear some really expert evidence. Professor Tidgley, for many years head laboratory attendant at the Naghurst Sheep Clinic Dispensary at Rogate and extension lecturer in oviology, ovigraphy and ovism at Kidderminster University, pointed out that the Gritstone mountain breed with mobile ears has a nose span of relatively 1/16 of an inch more than that of the Roscommon longwool.
Professor, how would these nose prints be made? I myself once took the nose print of a pet rabbit on some dripping, purely to amuse a young nephew who had been sent home for Swansea with measles.
Did it?
Would some similar method be employed?
Well, the current procedure is to smear the sheep's nose with some commercially available solution and then press it down on a carpet.
Might that not be distressing to the animal concerned?
No, not at all. Allow me to demonstrate, madam. Someone send out for some boot polish.
10 minutes later, Mrs. Retch, mindful of the great responsibility invested in her as chairman of this important inquiry, could be seen being gently impelled face first towards a cigarette card held aloft by Professor Tidgley, her great nose generously smeared with russet-coloured shoe wax. The other inquiry members stood round, cheering her valiantly on. And at this moment, her husband, Colonel Retch, entered the room.
And what is the meaning of this?
Oh, good Lord.
Clown practice?
It's not what it seems, dear. Honestly, it isn't.
Atta! Put it on. When we marry, you promised me no more circus.
Oh, dear.
But here I found you blasted in grease paint rehearsing some foul act.
No, you don't understand. There are sheep involved.
Animals, too, eh? Well, what Welsh will hear from me about this?
Oh,
trying once
dear.
Again to steal my wife away from me behind my back.
Oh, yes.
Obviously not an academic.
Oh, dear. I hope he doesn't do anything he'll regret afterwards.
And so the inquiry into nose prints, human or otherwise, came to a less than gracious end. However, following the resultant sensational reporting of the affair, Wagwell, proprietor of Wagwell's Circus, is considering introducing a nose printing act into his repertoire. He may even consider trying it himself, once the swelling on his own mistakenly punished proboscis has gone down. Colonel Retch, meanwhile, is learning to write complaining letters to the newspapers about circuses left-handed.
That was Beachcomber by the Way, adapted for radio by Michael Barfield, with Richard Ingrams, who appeared as Beachcomber. John Wells, June Whitfield, John Sessions, Joan Sims, Patricia Routledge, Simon Greenall, Brian Bowles, and Henrietta Garden played the other characters. Your announcer was Perkins, and the producer was Thompson.